What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
There is no biochemical reaction in the human body or in any animal cell, for that matter, on the planet that requires dietary fructose for any reaction. It is completely vestigial to all animal life on this planet. Nobody needs it, contrary to what the food industry says. They say, oh, well, you need sugar to live. If you need glucose, you can make it, and you don't need fructose under any circumstance. But it's sweet. And we love it because it stimulates the reward center. But it's not necessary. And in chronic doses, it causes cellular damage and ultimately cell death and ultimately human death.
I'm Doug Bopes, personal trainer, best-selling author, and entrepreneur, and I'm on a mission to help others become the best version of themselves. So I'd like to welcome you to the Adversity Advantage podcast, where we will help you use obstacles, failures, and setbacks to give you that edge needed for success. I'll be interviewing people from all walks of life on how they overcame trials and turned them into triumphs. So please, sit back, relax, and get ready to be absolutely blown away by some of the wisdom and stories you're about to hear. Welcome back to another episode of The Adversity Advantage. I'm your host, Doug Bobst, and today's guest is Dr. Robert Lustig. Dr. Lustig is professor of pediatrics at the University of California, San Francisco, and a neuroendocrinologist with expertise in obesity, diabetes, metabolism, and nutrition. Today on the show, we discuss the warning signs that you've been eating too much sugar, what sugar addiction actually is and how to recover from it, some common online misconceptions about sugar that you need to be aware of, Dr. Lustig's position on things like fruit juice, smoothies, and soda, the macronutrient he believes you should really pay attention to, and it's not protein, why managing your mental health is so important as it relates to eating too much sugar, and so much more. So let's get this conversation going and welcome Dr. Robert Lustig to the Adversity Advantage podcast. Rob, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
I'd love to jump right in. What do you think are some of the early warning signs that someone's been eating too much sugar?
Well, first of all, they will say to you, oh, I have a horrible sweet tooth. And how many people do you know who say that? In fact, virtually all of them. That's sugar addiction till proven otherwise. Now, the reason they'll say I have a horrible sweet tooth is because sugar addiction is not socially unacceptable. It is perfectly reasonable. And in fact, when people say, oh, I have a horrible sweet tooth, they're looking for, you know, codependence and enablers is what they're doing. The fact of the matter is that because sugar is not associated with violent crime, it's okay to be a sugar addict. You know, let's think of other addictive substances that don't lead to violent crime. Caffeine. It's okay to be a caffeine addict. And by the way, that's my drug of choice. And, you know, if you take my Starbucks away from me, I might have to kill you. So, you know, it makes itself manifest in different ways. But in fact, sugar addiction is extremely common. One of the issues is that the aberrant behaviors only come during the withdrawal phase. But the fact is, because sugar is so prevalent in all of our food, since 73% of the items in the American grocery store are spiked with added sugar for the food industry's purposes, not for you, you never actually have withdrawal. So you don't get to see the altered mental state of the sugar addict during withdrawal.
You mentioned like just saying, hey, I have a sweet tooth can be an early sign of eating too much sugar or being addicted to sugar. From a physical standpoint, what are some of the signs that you may be having acute withdrawal symptoms or you're addicted to sugar, but
you're not even aware of it. You could potentially think it's something else.
So sugar actually doesn't have that many obvious direct withdrawal symptoms. So let's define addiction. All right. Prior to 2013, you needed two behavioral phenomena to be an addictive substance. You had to demonstrate both tolerance, that is more and more for less and less. And that's because of downregulation of the dopamine receptor in the reward center of the brain, because dopamine downregulates its own receptor. Virtually all neurotransmitters downregulate their own receptors, and there's a reason for that. It's because dopamine is excitatory. Dopamine excites the next neuron. Now, neurons like to be excited. Neurons like to be stimulated. That's why they have receptors. But neurons like to be tickled, not bludgeoned. Chronic overstimulation of any neuron will lead to neuronal cell death, because the amount of energy it takes to fire is greater than the amount of energy it can burn at any one time. So if you have continuous firing, you will become energy depleted and you risk dying. Now, we know that because we have kids in the neurologic intensive care unit with chronic, you know, seizure disorders, status epilepticus, nonstop seizing, and we have to stop their seizures or they will lose neurons and they will end up becoming developmentally delayed and severely compromised. So it behooves us to get the neurons to calm down. Well, if you are constantly plying them with dopamine, they only have one way to calm down, and that is to reduce the number of receptors. So they downregulate their own receptor so that there's less chance that any given dopamine molecule will find a receptor to bind to. More and more for less and less. The law of diminishing returns. That's tolerance. And every addictive substance, and for that matter, every addictive behavior, does the same thing. It increases dopamine, which reduces the dopamine receptor. Okay, so that's number one. Number two, prior to 2013, the American Psychiatric Association said that for something to be addictive, you also had to demonstrate withdrawal. Now, withdrawal is very interesting, because if you look at the symptoms of withdrawal for any of the chemicals that we know have withdrawal, so heroin, cocaine, nicotine, they all have systemic effects when there's withdrawal. So the GI side effects of morphine, the mydriasis and the sweating of cocaine, etc. These are all outside of the brain side effects. All right. Sugar does not have those. Behaviors do not have those, but they're still addictive. Gambling does not have those, but they're still addictive. So in 2013, the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, number 5, they rewrote the definition of addiction. So it can be tolerance and withdrawal, or it can be tolerance and dependence. And dependence are all internal effects. Like, for instance, can't stop thinking about it, motivated to go seek it, you know, gets in the way of, you know, being able to function in society, alters your work habit and your sleep schedule, things like that. That's dependence. Now, sugar does not have tolerance and withdrawal. It has tolerance and dependence. So under the 2013 rubric, sugar is addictive. So those are the symptoms that one sees with sugar addiction.
When we talk about sugar, I think it's important to kind of define what we're talking about here, because I think people will then look at anything that has sugar in it, whether it be like fruit or anything like that, and compare it to a candy bar. And I think what I gather what you're talking about is really like these processed foods that have added sugar in them, is what you're referencing when it comes to sugar addiction. Like most people, I haven't seen anybody just take a table, like a spoon, and just eat sugar out of a jar. It's the hyper processed foods.
Exactly. You're absolutely right. So let's be very clear. First of all, let's define what I mean by sugar. You yourself said we need to do that. And I agree. So sugar, dietary sugar, sucrose, table sugar, cane sugar, beet sugar, the stuff you put in your coffee, the crystals that you spoon out and, you know, add them to your tea or your coffee or whatever. Okay, that is sucrose. That is one molecule of glucose and one molecule of fructose bound together. That's what that is. The fructose molecule is the sweet molecule. The glucose molecule is not all that sweet. Glucose would be like molasses. Now, Doug, do you like molasses?
I couldn't really tell you. I've never really had it, I don't think.
You know, I mean, it might be good in a certain kind of cookie, but, you know, you don't see people going around chugging Karo syrup, do you?
No.
Okay. You don't see people going around chugging Glucola. You know, I mean, there's no black market for Glucola. Okay, that's glucose. Doesn't taste that good. And the reason is because glucose does not stimulate the reward center. The sweetness index of the glucose molecule is only 0.74 compared to sucrose, which is 1.0. And it does not stimulate the reward center. So glucose is not that interesting. Fructose is the other molecule. And fructose is very interesting. Fructose is the molecule we seek. Fructose is the addictive molecule. Fructose is the one that stimulates the reward center, the nucleus accumbens. And it's been shown on neuroimaging, you know, that this is the case. Now, glucose is the energy of life. Every cell on the planet burns glucose for energy. Glucose is so important that if you don't consume it, your body makes it. It's called gluconeogenesis. You can turn amino acids into glucose, you can turn fat into glucose. But fructose, there is no biochemical reaction in the human body or in any animal cell, for that matter, on the planet that requires dietary fructose for any reaction. It is completely vestigial to all animal life on this planet. Okay? Nobody needs it, contrary to what the food industry says. They say, oh, well, you need sugar to live. Bullshit. Just garbage. You do not. All right? If you need glucose, you can make it, and you don't need fructose under any circumstance. Need it. All right? But it's sweet. It's got a sweetness index of 1.73. compared to sucrose at 1. Okay, so it's very sweet, and we love it because it stimulates the reward center. But it's not necessary. And in chronic doses, in high chronic doses, it causes cellular damage and ultimately cell death and ultimately human death. So, Doug, can you name a substance that is not necessary for life, that no biochemical reaction in the body requires it, that when consumed in excess causes cellular and human damage and death, and we love it anyway, and it's addictive?
Alcohol?
Alcohol, that's right. Alcohol is completely unnecessary, yet alcohol is loved by millions, and alcohol is addictive. But we don't need it. But we have it. And, you know, if you know how to consume it, you can manage it. But a lot of people can't. 20% of humans are either binge drinkers or chronic alcoholics. Same with sugar. And the reason is because sugar and alcohol are metabolized in the cell the same way. They are virtually identical. The big difference between sugar and alcohol is that for alcohol, the yeast does the first step of metabolism, which we call glycolysis. For sugar, we do our own first step. After that, the cell handles them exactly the same. The cell doesn't care where it came from. So that's why children now get the diseases of alcohol without alcohol. Type 2 diabetes and fatty liver disease were the diseases of alcohol. Now they're the diseases of five-year-olds. And the reason is because they have an alcohol substitute. It's called sugar.
And so I guess to bring this back to what we were talking about in the beginning, so sugar can be addictive, as you've said, and we're talking about processed foods when we're talking about sugar and the how they're added into foods, etc. And while it can be addictive, it's not to the same extent as things like cocaine, heroin, alcohol. Like as far as like people aren't destroying their lives to get these substances, but doesn't mean that it's not addictive.
And the reason is because sugar does not have withdrawal.
Right.
Substances that have withdrawal exhibit altered behaviors in the withdrawal state where people ruin their lives. So for cocaine, alcohol, heroin, nicotine, you know, we have those. Sugar is tolerance and dependence. So in the same way, caffeine has withdrawal, but it doesn't ruin lives. So just because, you know, something's addictive doesn't mean you ruin lives, but you can ruin your health.
And also, I think like when somebody's under the influence of something like alcohol, it's ruined a lot of relationships. You know, it can cause death from drinking and driving. It can also ruin your life while under the influence where, you know, people aren't destroying marriages from eating too many cookies. However, like you said, it can certainly destroy their health. How does like the cycle of sugar addiction intolerance work? Like the way I'm thinking of it as just somebody who's a former drug addict is if somebody eats like, you know, a pint of ice cream consistently for 2 weeks, are they now moving on to 2 pints, 3 pints? Like how does this all work for somebody?
Well, the fact of the matter is that sugar generates more sugar craving. This is well known. This is work that my colleague, Dr. Nicola Vina, did. She is a professor of neuroscience at Mount Sinai, and she is the one who demonstrated that sugar is addictive in both animals and in humans. So there are 4 criteria in animals for demonstrating addiction: tolerance, cravings, externalities. So externalities mean other things happen because you are consuming. And in animals, that means cross-sensitivity with other drugs of abuse. So if you, for instance, take a rat and you addict them to sugar and then expose them to amphetamine, you get a hyper response because they're already addicted, and vice versa. So there's only one reward system. There's only one dopamine system. And any of these substances can alter it. And so if you're addicted to one thing, you're addicted to all of them. And so when you try to remove one of the thing that you're addicted to, okay, you end up transferring that addiction to other things. This is known as addiction transfer. And this is why when people stop smoking, they start drinking. And when people stop drinking, they start eating. Okay, and vice versa. So there are several patients, that some of them famous, like Carney Wilson, who were massively obese, had bariatric surgery, and then became chronic alcoholics afterwards. And the reason was because when they had their bariatric surgery, they weren't generating that reward signal from food anymore, and they had to generate that reward signal somehow.
And so if somebody is looking to break free from addiction to sugar and processed foods, what does the process look like? Like how long do you think it can take for somebody if they're wanting to make this transformation? And like, what are the steps that somebody can take?
If they want to do something about it, the first thing they have to do is admit it. Admitting it is half the battle. Okay. We have a lot of people in denial. Right? That's number one. And if you're in denial, you'll never get better. It's just that simple. You know, you will make excuses, you know, every which way from Sunday as to why this is not a good week, or, you know, I can't do it right now, or blah, blah, blah. You know, the bottom line is the first thing is admitting it. Now, how one can deal with it after. ultimately, you can't alter an addiction until you've regenerated your dopamine receptors. Your dopamine receptors are at low ebb. If you take the dopamine away, now you have no ligand and fewer receptors. Now you feel really lousy. And we know from both pharmacologic studies in animals, and we also know in human studies with imaging, that it takes at least 3 weeks to repopulate those reward neurons, you know, their dopamine receptors, in order to bring the dopamine receptor level back up. So you now have people in Silicon Valley going on what are known as dopamine fasts, okay, where they lock themselves up in a hotel room and take the screens away and take the M&Ms away and take all of the sugar away and the alcohol away and basically, you know, read books until their dopamine receptors come back up so that they can feel something. That's pretty remarkable that this is actually a thing. Look, you know, for your audience, look it up. Dopamine fast. How bizarre is that? But that's what we've got. So if your dopamine receptors are at low ebb, if you want to actually feel something, if you've been a cocaine addict and you actually want to feel something, you have to go on a dopamine fast. Now, are there less extreme ways of dealing with this? Of course there are. Can you wean? And the answer is, yeah, of course you can wean. In the same way you can wean heroin, you can wean, cocaine. But then you have to be on a program, you know, where the a dose is being monitored. And the problem is that if the food is so completely overrun with added sugar because the food industry put it there, how are you going to monitor yourself and how are you going to limit your exposure? If the goal is reduction in sugar consumption, do you even know what is in your food? You know, you can look at the side of the package and say, well, do I know if there's added sugar in here? There are 262 names for sugar, and the food industry uses all of them. So, you know, you don't know what's in it. Did you know Pinocchio is sugar? Did you know Demerara is sugar? Evaporated cane juice, you might have been able to figure out, is sugar. Okay, they use strawberry puree. That's sugar. Okay, the point is there's a lot of stuff in your food that you didn't know was there. And so it's very hard to do the weaning because you don't know when you're exposed. What if there was cocaine in all your food and the food industry didn't tell you? How would you avoid it? Same issue.
So if somebody's admitted that they've had a problem, they've paid attention to some of these early warning signs that we've talked about, whether it be denial or, you know, saying you have a sweet tooth, et cetera, and they want to make this change. If it were you, knowing what you know, how would you do it effectively and how long do you think it would take you?
So if I wanted to do it effectively, I would basically do a cold turkey. What we've learned, and we actually did this experiment in children. We, in 2010 through 2015, we conducted a study here at UCSF. And to this day, I'm still in awe of the results of this study. It's really remarkable. What we did was we took 43 children from our obesity clinic at UCSF with metabolic syndrome, all low socioeconomic status, all high sugar consumers, because that's what their parents fed them. That's what they could afford. And what we did was we studied them on their home diet. We figured out what they were eating on their home diet. We studied them on their home diet. And then for the next 9 days, we took the added sugar out of their diet. We catered their meals 3 days at a time. No added sugar. We took their percent consumption of added sugar as calories from 28% of calories down to 10% of calories. We gave them fruit. That's it. Okay, but all of the rest of their food was no added sugar. Now, we didn't have to like make funky food. We just bought it at Safeway. But we chose the food to be no added sugar food because 20 7% of the grocery store is no added sugar. We controlled for their carbohydrate intake total. We controlled for their protein intake total. We controlled for their fat intake total. We controlled for their fiber intake total. So they ate the same amount of carbohydrate as normal, but instead of sugar, we gave them complex carbohydrate. We gave them starch. We did a starch for sugar exchange. All right. And we gave them a scale. And every day, our coordinator would call them up on the phone, "What'd you weigh?" And if they were losing weight, "Eat more," in order to keep their weight stable, because we didn't want the naysayers to say, "Well, of course they got better, they lost weight." We wanted them to stay the same weight or even gain weight for that matter. We did this for 10 days. And then we restudied them on their low sugar, normal calorie, normal carbohydrate diet, but without sugar. So a fructose restricted diet. Okay, glucose added, fructose taken away. And what we saw was remarkable. Every aspect of their metabolic health improved. Their blood pressure went down by 5 points. Their insulin area under the curve went down by 25%. Their glucose area under the curve went down by 8%, even though they were getting more glucose. They had a lactate level at baseline. You're not supposed to have a lactate level at baseline. If you do, that means you have mitochondrial dysfunction, which they did. And that got better. All right. Everything we looked at improved. And their beta cells started working properly. And we published this back in 2016 through 2019, all the data from this. Now, these kids were being sugar restricted on our, you know, makeshift diet. How did they fare at home? For the first week, actually 5 days, for the first 5 days, the parents thought these kids were going to kill them. They were nasty. They were angry. They were irritable. The teachers noticed it. It was not good. Those first 5 days. And then the fever broke and they became receptive and compliant and nice and were able to study. And the teachers noticed that they weren't causing trouble in the classroom. And the parents realized that their kids were actually nice kids. And the kids noticed it too. And they never went back. They realized that the sugar was causing all of their behavioral difficulties, their irritability, their inability to concentrate, because sugar, fructose, is a mitochondrial toxin all throughout the body, but also in the brain. And so if your mitochondria are not working, you don't feel good. And it took about 5 days for the behavioral aspects of their sugar dependence to change.
It's super interesting. So there is some, I guess, acute withdrawal symptoms from sugar, you know, being like irritable, maybe a little anxious, stressed, depressed, etc., right?
Exactly. You can't measure it in terms of, you know, like sweating or cardiac, you know, or heart rate, you know, increase and things like that, that you see with withdrawal from other, you know, mydriasis, you know, the eye, that you see from other addictive substances.
So you would say like the best approach for somebody who's really serious about this is to just remove ultra processed foods and then eat a more wholesome or a diet comprised of whole foods. And again, it seems what I've heard you say is when you're talking about sugar, you're not talking about fruit, correct? Because I think a lot of times people, they kind of interchange those two things, and then people are afraid of eating food that's actually good for them.
Right. So let's do the sugar and fruit story. Okay, because everyone always asks about it and say, "Well, you're telling me I can't eat fruit?" No, that's not what I'm saying at all. Here's the problem. You get a sugar bolus into your stomach and then your duodenum and then your jejunum. It gets absorbed. It goes straight to the liver. The liver can metabolize a limited amount. in the same way it can metabolize a limited amount of alcohol. If you stay below that level, then the fructose didn't do any damage. But the chances are that you overexceeded your limit. For adult men, that limit is about 37 grams a day. For adult women, that's about 25 grams a day. For kids, it's about 12.5 grams a day. For toddlers, it's about 3 grams a day. And for infants, it's like 0 grams a day. Okay? So there's a limit to how fast your liver can clear the fructose. If you stay below that level, you'll be fine. Well, fruit does have fructose in it. It does. But it's at low level. It's not like, you know, fruit is absolutely, you know, chock, smack, you know, glommed, you know, full of fructose. There's actually, yes, it's sweet, but it's not crazy sweet. Okay. And the fruit has the antidote packaged right alongside the sugar. It's called fiber. The fiber in the fruit forms a gel on the inside of the intestine. And what that gel does, the soluble and the insoluble fiber together form this gel. And you can actually see it on electron microscopy. It forms a secondary barrier that prevents absorption of glucose and fructose into the bloodstream. So number one, you have a lower dose because it's fruit compared to, say, a fruit juice. And number two, the fiber in the fruit acts as a barrier that prevents absorption so that you're not overwhelming your liver. You're not causing the liver to basically give up because you've made it awash in this huge tsunami of sugar that you've exposed it to. So fruit is okay because, number one, the dose is lower and the fiber is there. And that's what makes fruit okay. Fruit juice is another story because the fiber has been removed and the sugar has been concentrated. Because how many apples can you eat? You know, but how many glasses of apple juice can you drink?
I'd love to dive more into that because in prepping for this, I was talking to somebody yesterday and I was like, why is it so much easier for somebody to drink orange juice than to eat an orange? Like, I would love for you to share your thoughts on fruit juice and why or why not it's as healthy as eating fruit.
My cookbook co-author, who is a nutrition educator in the East Bay in Walnut Creek, her name is Cindy Gershon. And every year, you know, she taught the nutrition sciences class over at Mount Diablo High School. And every year, she always started with the same first experiment on the first day. Okay, so the kids are coming in. These are all, you know, this is a Title I school with, you know, poor kids, you know, who probably haven't even eaten breakfast. All right. And they all come in and she takes two kids from the class as the experiment. And she hands one kid 6 oranges. And she says to the first kid, here's 6 oranges. Make juice. So the kid squeezes the 6 oranges, gets 12.5 ounces, downs the glass and says, okay, what's for breakfast? The second kid, she hands the kid 6 oranges and she says to the kid, here, kid, eat the 6 oranges. Kid eats orange number 1, orange number 2, orange number 3, gets to orange number 4 and throws up. She's got the vomit basin ready because it always happens on orange number 4. Okay. And the kid goes, I'm gonna die. And then the kid doesn't eat lunch or dinner either. So what happened? The fiber happened. The fiber made the fruit self-limiting. The fiber reduced your capacity to overconsume. And the reason is because the fiber moves the food through the intestine faster to get to the end of the intestine where the satiety signal, or the peptide YY hormone, lives. So the food gets to the end, the peptide YY gets released into the bloodstream, goes to the brain, tells the brain, I am satiated. I'm not going to eat another drop. The fiber makes that happen faster. So that's why the fruit is okay, because the fiber does double duty. It acts at the intestine to reduce absorption, and it also acts to reduce at the end of the intestine to reduce consumption.
And so when somebody drinks fruit juice instead of eating fruit,
they're not getting either of those.
It's essentially comparable to eating some of these sugary ultra processed foods that we've been referencing and talking about throughout the conversation, right?
Ultra processed food is fiberless food. And the reason is because you can't freeze fiber. I'll prove it to you. Tonight, take an orange, put it in your freezer overnight. Take it out in the morning, put it on the kitchen countertop, let it thaw, try to eat it, see what you get. You get mush. Why do you get mush? Because the ice crystals macerate the cell wall, let all the water rush in. Hey, food industry knows that. So what do? Squeeze it and freeze it. Now it lasts forever. Now it's frozen concentrated orange juice. They have taken a food, an orange, and they have turned it into a commodity. Frozen concentrated orange juice, which they can sell on the commodities exchange, because commodity means storable food, food that won't go bad. So when you take the fiber out, the shelf life increases. Well, that's good for the food industry's profit, but that fiber was actually good for you. That was actually something you needed for your nutrition. So they basically gave you a commodity that was nutritionally depleted.
That's wild. Like, what about some of the foods that people typically might feel are healthy, like certain cereals or even certain protein bars that have fiber in them? Like, where does the fiber come from? And do you recommend people eating those or staying away from them?
Right. So there are two kinds of fiber. I mentioned it before, soluble and insoluble. So soluble fibers like pectin or inulin, like what holds jelly together. Insoluble fibers, cellulose, like the stringy stuff in celery or cardboard for that matter. Okay. All that's cellulose. Now, real food has both. You need both. And the reason is because the insoluble fiber, the stringy stuff, forms a lattice work on that inside of that intestine, that gel I mentioned. Okay. It has a structure. It has a lattice work, like a fishnet, if you will. Okay. The soluble fiber, they're globular. They plug the holes in the fishnet. And so together, they form this secondary barrier. When the food industry takes the fiber out of the food, they take both out. They take the soluble and insoluble. Okay, so now it's fiberless food. Some companies will try to add fiber back, like Fiber One bars, okay, high fiber cereal. And what they're adding back is usually something like inulin, which is immunogenic and can cause GI distress, or psyllium, like what's in Metamucil. Okay, which gels if you add water to it, you know. And that's not necessarily setting up that gel like, you know, we talked about, because there's no insoluble fiber. And the food industry hasn't figured out how to add insoluble fiber back to food yet. So what the food industry is doing is basically telling you, oh, yeah, we put the fiber back. Yeah, we put the soluble fiber back. But we didn't put all the fiber back. We didn't put the insoluble fiber back. And therefore, it's not really working like you want it to.
I'd love to get your thoughts on smoothies, because I think a lot of times when people are trying to make a health transformation and transition from eating a diet that's full of ultra-processed foods and eating more whole foods, smoothies can become a way for them to do that. What are your thoughts on smoothies? Are they in the same category as fruit juice? Like, how do you feel about that?
So there are two kinds of smoothies. There's fruit smoothies and there's green smoothies. Fruit smoothies have sugar. Green smoothies don't. Okay, green smoothies are vegetables. The question is, what are you trying to prevent the absorption of? And the answer is, in the green smoothie, nothing. So if you take all the vegetables and throw it into a Vitamix or a Breville or a Magic Bullet or Cuisinart or whatever else, whatever machine you prefer, okay? And you smoothie the green vegetables to smithereens and you basically destroy all the insoluble fiber because you've sheared it into such a gamish that there's no lattice work, there's no fishnet to be able to construct. It doesn't matter because there was nothing to inhibit the absorption of. So green smoothie, if you want to destroy your insoluble fiber, have at it. Who cares? On the other hand, the fruit smoothie's got lots of sugar in it. Now, not as much as a soda, but still lots of sugar. And the goal is to keep that gel, that meshwork, that latticework, that fishnet intact. Well, if you take all that fruit and throw it in a smoothing machine, the blades of the machine are going to shear those insoluble fiber strands into nothingness. They won't be able to build the fishnet in the intestine. And now you will absorb all of that sugar that came from the fruit. So the way I look at it is, eat your fruit, don't drink it.
You often hear that fiber, one of the big benefits of fiber is satiety benefits, right? It helps keep you fuller longer. You hear the same also about protein. Do you think that adding in a good quality protein powder to a fruit smoothie can be beneficial as far as how the body responds to it?
So that sounds like a good idea. And on the surface, it might be a good idea, but in fact, you have to delve a little bit deeper here. So protein powder that you buy at, you know, at the general at GNC or the health food store or whatever, okay, the thing the bodybuilders, you know, add to their smoothies, right? What is that? What is in protein powder? And the answer is it's a lot of branched chain amino acids. BCAAs, they're called. Branched chain amino acids. Leucine, isoleucine, valine. Now, muscle is 20% branched chain amino acids. So if you're building muscle, if you're a bodybuilder and you're pumping iron, then you need those branched chain amino acids in order to be able to build muscle. By the way, those are essential amino acids. You have to consume them. Your body doesn't make them. You know, there are 20 amino acids, but you only have to consume 9. They're essential. The body can turn those 9 into the other 11, okay, to get the 20. But you got to eat the 9. And it turns out all these branched chain amino acids are all essential. So the only place you get them is your food. All right. So if you're a bodybuilder and you need branched chain amino acids, add a scoop of protein powder to your smoothie. No sweat, because you have a place to put them. But what if you're not a bodybuilder? What if you're a mere mortal like me? Okay. And you eat a porterhouse steak. Okay, because you're probably not drinking a smoothie, but you're eating a steak and it's filled with branched chain amino acids because it was a corn-fed beef and corn has lots of branched chain amino acids. What are you going to do if you're not building muscle? What happens to the amino acids if you're not building muscle? They go to the liver. The liver can't store them because the only place to store them is in muscle. So the liver has to do something with them. It takes the amino group off. So now it's a branched chain organic acid. And then that gets filtered into the Krebs cycle, the tricarboxylic acid cycle, the cycle that creates energy in the liver. Problem is the TCA cycle gets overwhelmed. And when the cycle gets overwhelmed, the liver has a failsafe, a pop-off, and that gets turned into fat. So those branched chain amino acids end up as liver fat. And then that liver fat can either be exported out, raising your triglycerides and increasing your risk for heart disease or obesity, or that liver fat will precipitate in the liver. Now you've got fatty liver disease, which puts you at greater risk for diabetes and Alzheimer's disease. So branched chain amino acids are okay if you're building muscle and not okay if you're not. So for the bodybuilders out there, don't kill me. You know, if you want to put a scoop of protein powder in your smoothie and you're building muscle, great, have at it. But do I think this is a good idea for everyone else? No.
When it compares to soda, you touched on soda earlier. If somebody is just looking to make something that's sweet for them, that's going to be a better option than soda if they were somebody that habitually drinks soda every day or every week, smoothies aren't as bad as soda, correct?
No. I mean, soda's like the worst because it's basically straight sugar, no fiber, no nothing, no nutrition whatsoever. I mean, sodas are the devil incarnate. I mean, without question. Trans fats used to be, but we know that. And so they're now removed from our diet. So now it's soda. And we're doing everything we can to try to reduce consumption of soda in this country. And it is very difficult, as you know. But if you're going to stop drinking soda, then maybe you would start drinking diet soda. Okay, because after all, no calories, no fructose should be better, right? Well, not necessarily. Turns out those diet sweeteners have their own effects, and those effects are not necessarily good ones. Turns out they change the microbiome, they change the bacteria in the intestine, and they increase intestinal gut permeability, thus a phenomenon called leaky gut, which sets you up for insulin resistance and chronic metabolic disease also. And also when you put something sweet on the tongue, like a diet, you know, sweetener, message goes tongue to brain, sugar's coming, message goes brain to pancreas, sugar's coming, release the insulin. And it turns out you still make insulin. And if you make insulin, you're going to drive energy into fat and you're still going to generate chronic metabolic disease. So the data on diet sweeteners is that one Coca-Cola, the toxicity of one Coca-Cola equals the toxicity of two Diet Coca-Colas. So half as bad. Now, half as bad does not mean good. It means half as bad. All right? The problem is that the diet soda drinker thinks I can have 10 of them.
But then as far as somebody who wants to shift from soda to smoothies, clearly, though, that's a better option for somebody because at least they're not just downing just straight sugar, right?
Sure. I mean, there's less sugar in each piece of fruit than there is in a soda, absolutely. And there's still some soluble fiber to be had, which is better. And also, you know, there are micronutrients in the fruit that are not in the soda. By the way, there's also pesticides. So if you're going to do that, make sure it's organic.
A lot of addictions stem from some sort of root cause, where it's somebody's inability to manage stress, anxiety, depression, trauma, their environment, etc. Do you think it's important for somebody to look at that first to make sure that they're not just reaching for sugary foods in a response to deal with their life?
This is a very good question, Doug. And I will tell you, you know more than I do, having lived through it yourself. Here's what I can say. There is an area of your brain called the amygdala. And the amygdala is the fear center of the brain. And the amygdala drives almost all chronic disease. And our amygdalas are on fire. They are just disinhibited like nobody's business. So the question is, do you fix the food or do you fix the amygdala first? Well, if you fix the food, the amygdala gets better. If you fix the amygdala, the food gets better. Both are true. The question is, what do you do first? And the answer is, I think it depends on who you are. But both need to happen.
But it seems what humans are made to brave sugar and even like salty foods when we're stressed. Like, why is that? Is that something that we've just learned? Is it learned behavior or is it something biological?
No, it's biological. Without question, it's biological. So basically, when you're stressed, you have increased neuronal firing. And so you have to supply a steadier stream of energy. So that's one of the reasons for wanting to consume sugar. And also salt, because you're actually trying to raise blood pressure, because that helps you run away from the lion. You know, that's an adaptive response to stress, is increasing blood pressure, increasing heart rate, you know, in response to amygdala activation. So these are all adaptive principles in the acute situation, which become maladaptive in the chronic situation. And we're all chronically stressed.
Last question I have for you is, if somebody's listening to this and they're understanding and resonating with what you're saying, and they're like, all right, I'm going to break free from my addiction to sugar, I'm going to eat more whole foods, I'm going to get more fiber into my diet, etc., but they want to do this long term, what foods do you think are best to incorporate into somebody's diet so that long term they're not going to fall into the same trap they did before?
There is a food processing categorization system called NOVA, it's called the NOVA system. It was developed by my colleague in Sao Paulo, Dr. Carlos Montero. And it talks about the degree of food processing instead of what's in the food, what's been done to the food. And there are four classes of NOVA. NOVA, so the best way to explain this would be an example. Let's take an apple. NOVA class one would be an apple picked off a tree. NOVA class two would be apple slices, destemmed, deseeded, maybe deskinned. NOVA class three would be apple sauce, macerated, preservative added, maybe a little bit of extra sugar. NOVA class four would be a McDonald's apple pie. Now, is there any apple in that McDonald's apple pie? Probably not.
Wishful thinking. Okay. Right?
It's certainly not recognizable as apple, without question. All right. Point is, it has now been shown that only the NOVA class four category of food is associated with chronic metabolic disease. Only the NOVA class four. The NOVA class one through three, no problem. So the question is, how do you know? How do you know what's NOVA class one through three, and how do you avoid NOVA class four? Well, I am the chief medical officer of a company that has developed a tool to do just that. So the company is called PERFACT, P-E-R-F-A-C-T, not perfect, PERFACT. And you can find it at perfact.co. And if you go to that website, you will see that there are four filters. What it does is it filters everything in your grocery store so that you will only see what's healthy for you. So if you want to be gluten-free, it will only show you the gluten-free options. If you want to be sugar-free, it will only show you the sugar-free options. If you want to be peanut-free, it will only show you the peanut-free options, and on and on and on. And one of the filters is the NOVA filter. And so what it will do is it will filter out the NOVA class 4 items from your grocery store. And we did this for Amazon, Walmart, and Target. So at baseline, it shows you 40,000 items. After you've applied the NOVA class 4 filter, you are now down to 10,000 items because it has filtered out 75% of the grocery store. So if you want to maintain your health, if you want to not go back, then the thing to do is use the NOVA filter and stick to that. And then you can purchase your food from the grocery store right on the app.
I've heard you say in the past that you generally recommend a pescatarian diet. Is that still the case, or have you changed your mind on that?
No, that's about right. Fish and vegetables is really good. Okay. You get all the omega-3s you need. You get all the fiber you need. Okay. And you don't get anything you don't.
Well, Rob, this has been awesome. Thank you so much for your time. If people want to learn more about your work, connect with you, where's the best place to do that?
Well, I got a website, robertlustig.com, or you can go to profiles.ucsf.edu/robert.lustig, or, you know, just to be honest with you, just put my name into your web searcher and you'll find it. You know, I was on the Huberman Lab podcast, 3.5 hours. It was, you know, marathon, longer than a marathon for that matter. You know, there's a lot of information in there that will help people. Bottom line is I'm easy to find. I've written books, Flat Fat Chance, Hacking of the American Mind, which is very relevant to addiction. It's about addiction and depression. And also, most recently, Metabolical. I'm easy to find.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I think my audience is really going to enjoy this one.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Doug.